All right, this is tape four, side A. Another question, moving down sort of the policy, public policy side of this question set, is about labs, your lab's scientific agenda. Given the limited resources, I know that earlier you talked about maybe you see the direction of your lab going in the next 2 or 3 years. That's more, maybe more long-term than this question is asking about. But given the limited resources in your lab and in every lab, what criteria do you use to choose one project rather than another?
So that has a lot to do with what I think is good science, I think. So what I think is good science is a kind of science that has impact on broad range, of people. So more the general effect it has, it's better. And obviously, it's a positive effect. For example, if your discovery changes people's thinking about something really fundamental in biology, that's really good work. So I try to, I want every student in my lab to have an opportunity to write a big paper. Big paper means the paper that has high impact. So that's one big thing about me in choosing the project. But also, I know everybody has preference. Some people are very good at biochemistry, but hate looking at cells. So those people are not good at genetics, and vice versa. So I ask them what they like, and we choose from there. Sometimes I can tell clearly this student is good, better at this kind of work than the other, and then I sort of arrange in that way. Mm-hmm. I never tell them you should do this and that, and come up with, rather than doing that, I try to come up with consensus. But if you do well, you can sort of guide them to the direction you want to, usually. So I never had a problem with that. So big potential for big impact, and what kind of research the students might fit well. So those are two things that I care most.
All right. We know that on the national level, too, the criteria that's used to determine what projects are undertaken, you know, at different labs, can be affected by many different things, like 9/11 and sort of the surge of bioterrorist sort of research. There was recently there was breast cancer research, for instance, too, and that was, I think, initiated from PACs and some community groups, but then it also was pushed by the Senate. So politics plays quite a bit in determining the direction of U.S. science. You have celebrities who play a part of it. In your mind, what is the ideal criteria? What would be the ideal criteria for determining how this sort of limited amount of money that the NIH has, and how that money is spent and allocated?
That's a very big issue.
It is.
I know from politicians' point of view, they have to have something that they can be proud of. We accomplished this and that. In that sense, it's probably inevitable for them to come up with those things. For example, Clinton came up with AIDS vaccine, and he declared that it should be done in 10 years, and the NIH built a huge institute for that. Nobody talks about it now, though. And it's been 10 years, I think. But so on one hand, I would say it's understandable, though I prefer that kind of thing won't take up too much money, because I think we are not clever enough to say to predict what would be most useful. The history says that. It's very clear that a lot of discoveries that change the society came from like unexpected direction. So ideally, I think if we can support as broad science as possible, that's the best way to for the future to come up with research that would impact our society. So focusing on one thing limits that, especially by taking out funds. And the things that are supposed to be not very exciting anymore turning out to be something really exciting because one discovery, this happened a lot of times in the past. So I think it's ideal if NIH can support as broad range of science as possible. And if politicians want to have their own stuff, very focused research, I hope they would come up with additional money for that rather than taking out money from NIH.
Right.
We should all realize that we are not smart enough to predict what's going to be useful.
So spread the wealth.
Right.
Bets.
On the other and also, I know from my experience, we cannot do good research unless we're excited about it. So I'm hoping that I don't have to change the direction of research due to the limits in funding.
Right.
I mean, I know it sounds pretty rude, but the ideal situation is to do the research that we are excited about the most. And regarding that, I'm pretty sure we can be very honest and we can work as hard as possible. If everybody does that, someone's research will be useful as a result, but it cannot be the goal, I think, because we just cannot predict what's going to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be the result, not the goal. That's what I think.
Yeah. Do you think that breadth exists now within the NIH? You know, the money?
I don't think so.
No.
I think NIH is, at least what I heard is, NIH is getting a little bit more focused or short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
To that, you know, this is an investment, we want return, kind of. So I'm a little bit worried, but at the same time, I know this goes ups and downs in waves, so probably it's going to come back sometime.
Yeah.
I have quite good trust in that sense. History at least tells us that it's going to come back.
Yeah. It would be interesting to track budget crises, mm-hmm. national budget crises,
in right.
this trend that you're talking about,
right.
because there might be some linkage to
right.
it. The Pew, as you know, has an initiative to try to better understand the connection between science and society, or I guess to make the communication between the two,
mm-hmm.
To facilitate that a bit more. What do you feel is the average scientist's responsibility for communicating what science is about, what their research is about, and why the public should be interested? Or do they have a responsibility to do that?
I think we do, because, well, I think it's ideal. I think it's good that public is interested in science. It's a lot more prominent in this country than in Japan, actually. I'm surprised how much people are interested in science. And I think that's a big part of why science is strong in this country. And because of that, and because we are getting public funding, I think we have obligation to return some of our knowledge to public. It's definitely a good thing for people to be interested in science. Otherwise, good students won't come to science. I think it's a positive thing.
And what would be an effective way to do that, though? In other words, how do you improve the science literacy of Americans?
For example, I know at MIT, researchers have obligations to go to local high schools and give talks and or to interact with students. Maybe a lot of students are too shy to come out and talk in front of their classmates. Maybe we can have programs that every lab receives a high school student who is interested in
mm-hmm.
science. Something like that would be good. I actually like having young people working in my lab because they get excited about just running gel or making one mm-hmm. plasmid, and it's really refreshing to see those. And it is a lot of work from our side, but something like that might be, if a lot of labs do that, I think definitely that changes. If one person, a class, or one person from 1 year of one school fall in love with science in that way, I think that's something we can, something positive we can do to the society. An upper level, I actually don't know anything about what we do, what scientists do in recommendation to government or advice on science policies and so on and so forth. That part I have no idea. But I think it's very important for us to make effort to keep public interested in science.
Right.
And it's a good idea to start from schools, I think.
Now, have you participated here at the center or elsewhere in any of these public policy debates or questions?
No.
No.
But this place has a program called SEP, a Science Education Partnership. So every summer, I think secondary student has opportunity to work with local high school teachers and set up some experiments. And they come here for over 8 to 10 weeks with graduate students and do experiments. And Hutch loans the equipment so that those teachers can go back to their school and use those equipments in class. Mm. And sometimes those students work in the lab. So I had some high school students for a couple of summers, and I talked to them. Mm-hmm. It's always fun. Mm. And those students actually go to high schools and give talks also.
Right. All right. We have reached near the last part of the question set. It's mostly about your lab and then questions of gender and race. How big is your lab now?
My lab is composed of 7 people, including myself, I believe. It's 4 students, a postdoc technician, myself. Yeah, 7.
Right, and has it stayed at that level, more or less?
No, it expanded recently. At one time, my lab had only 2 people, myself and the technician. That was the smallest I ever had. And then got 3, 4. So last 3 years or so, it's been between 4 and 8.
Mm. And what is the makeup of your lab in terms of nationality?
They're all Americans, which is a little bit of a surprise for a person who came from NIH.
Right.
we had only 1 American in my lab that I did graduate work. No, postdoc work, excuse me. So it's interesting. I think that's partly Seattle thing. This program has a lot of Americans, not many foreigners, and the city is very American also. Mm-hmm. Well, that's probably not true. There are a lot of Asians, though they are Asian Americans, so yeah.
Mm. And how about the makeup in terms of gender? How many women and men?
So we have 3 women and 4 men, I think. But I actually don't care much about gender. As long as a person is good, I will hire the person no matter what. So I won't be surprised down the road if my lab becomes all female or male transiently. You know, because the size of the lab is small, you can have the fluctuation. And whoever is good will come.
Okay, yeah. How about how many postdocs and graduate students?
I have one postdoc, 1 technician, and 4 graduate students.
Given your own experience in graduate school, and now we're talking about Japan as well, do you feel that the playing field is level between men and women, PIs, in biomedical sciences?
In Japan, no. In grad school, I think, well, actually, I'm not in a position to be able to say that because My boss had only one student, that was me. But my girlfriend was in Kyoto, and I don't think she was treated differently only because she was a woman. So up to graduate school level, I don't think it's a big deal. And in Japan, a lot of times, students, graduate students are hired directly to be sort of research assistant professor equivalent. At that level, I don't think it's equal to men and women. I think the women have big disadvantage. And I can say that because my sister tried to look for a job for a while, and I'm pretty sure she would have gotten a job a lot easily if she was a man.
And where does that come from? Where does that discrimination originate?
I think it's coming from the it's a social thing, I think. It's a more male chauvinistic society, that's for sure. And the people who are in power are old men, and a lot of people are afraid of women taking over power, and it's easy for them to keep in that way because they're in power right now. It's changing slowly, but for example, my institute had a female full professor, was the first female full professor in Japanese National University.
Wow.
And there were, I don't remember, 20 labs or so, but she was only a female professor in the university. But the institute was so proud of having a female professor. So that tells you how rare it is. Again, it's changing slowly, but I think it takes time. And obviously, up to graduate level, it's not that obvious, I don't think. And when you go to sort of, if you will, real society, as soon as you try to get a job, I think a lot of people hit the wall in Japan. But I can only guess because I never had a real job in Japan. But that's my feeling. In this country, it's obviously a lot less prominent. I actually don't know really how whether or not women are equally treated, probably because having very limited life staying my lab all the time. From looking at my girlfriend, even I don't think she has been treated in unfair manner because she's a woman. I don't think. I never heard her complain about it. But of course, she's from a Japanese society, which is a lot more less respectful for women. So maybe her standard is lower than American women. I won't be surprised if she's not as sensitive to that matter as people here. So, but as far as I can tell, I don't think she had any trouble of being treated in unfair manner because of her gender.
Right.
So I'm pretty happy about that.
And how many women do you find in PI positions in your department here at the Hutchinson Center?
In this department, Susan, Cecilia, Linda, Sue, Suzanne. I think it's 6 or 7 out of 30. Yeah.
Okay.
So Hutch, I know, had sort of a reputation of being male chauvinistic or being, and I know that this division tried to hire senior female faculty member for quite a while, and that is sort of can be a little tricky because if you hire someone only because the person is a woman, it's a sort of reverse discrimination. Or even worse, if someone is promoted or hired only because the person is a woman, and you know, if the hatch or division decide to lower standard for that, it's really bad for them and to women, I think, because then people say, oh, okay, they have the double standard. It's not, I don't think that's a way of respecting people. In that sense, I think we did a very good job of hiring someone who's very, very good, and I'm very happy about that. And again, just like what I said, for the intern, for my own laboratory, I really don't care much about gender. As long as someone is good, that person has to be hired or promoted. And that should be only the reason for evaluation.
Right. And where do the bulk of your female students go? I mean, do they go into industry? Do they become PIs?
I only have one student graduated who went back to a medical school. Mm-hmm. So I actually don't know. But I expect most of them doing postdoc after here.
Do women do science differently than men, in your opinion?
I don't think so. As far as I can tell, individual difference is a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, the difference between men and difference between women is probably bigger than just men and women as a whole. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that.
I mean, another issue is ethnicity. African Americans and Latinos, for instance, are two of several underrepresented groups in science. Mm-hmm. Maybe underrepresented here in Seattle. I don't know. I haven't looked
at
the demographics.
It's hugely underrepresented.
Yeah.
So I came from D.C. area, and of course, D.C. is a city for black people. Mm-hmm. And because NIH is a government institution, they had to hire, they had to have a certain population, I think. So there are a lot of black people at the NIH, and one thing I feel a little strange here is that we just don't see black people at the NIH and at the Hutch and even in the city much at all. And there are not so many Latino people either. So I miss that ethnic mixture a little bit that mm-hmm. I used to feel at the NIH. But, I mean, it's not like Hutch is discriminated by anything. This just, the city just doesn't have a lot of black people and Latino people, and I wish it's a little bit more mixture.
Right. In science generally, though, those groups are underrepresented as well. I mean, mm-hmm. what, to your mind, can be done to bring those groups into science?
Yeah, so that's...
That's another big question.
Yeah. of course, so that comes to things like affirmative action, I think.
Right.
So regarding affirmative action, I also have mixed feeling. On one hand, you know, there's a group of people who are underrepresented. Why don't we help? I understand that. At the same time, if people can get into a school at a lower score only because the person is from a certain ethnic group, it's also, just as I said, for gender problem, it's not really the way we should treat people with respect, because if there's a black person who got into school because that person was smart enough, people might see this person, you know, got in because he's black or she's black.
Right.
And ideally, if we don't have to have affirmative action, that's a great thing. If we have a situation we don't have to worry about. So, but at the same time, under the situation that certain ethnic group is underrepresented, it may not be a bad thing to have. So when to get rid of it, I think depends on the local society, and it's something that local society has to decide, I think. But what I hear, I actually don't know personally anyone, but my girlfriend's technician, ex-technician, used to be a person who's from a sort of like slum. He's a Latino, but he has a Latino background. One thing he told her is that it's not that the biggest problem in the society he grew up is that people think there's no hope. People just don't know that there are ways to get out. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest problem, not just not anything else. So just by letting people know there are ways to get education, that can change quite a bit.
Right.
So how to do it, I actually don't have a clear answer right now. But because a lot of times people don't know anyone who have been through schools and get education. If there are people like that close by that kids talk to on a regular basis, that probably changes a lot. Mm-hmm. Or if in school people can teach their ways to get education, or invite people who are from the same kind of background and went to school and got education and changed their lives, that might change. So letting people know on regular basis, not just once or twice a year, that there are ways to get education, if things change from there, that's probably a lot better than having affirmative action and try to fix things at the end in an artificial way.
Right.
But for short fix, if that needs to be done, it's okay. But at the same time, long-term solution should be done, I think, to offer more opportunities or let people know that there are ways.
Right.
Yeah.
It comes down to information again.
Right.
Getting the word out.
Yeah.
I know the Japanese is a very different society. It's homogenous. I mean, but are there any connections in terms of ethnicity and discrimination in Japan?
Yeah. It's one thing that I'm not very proud of. I think it's because, as you said, the Japanese society is very homogeneous. People tend to be very insensitive about discrimination because they don't have to think about it. So I think people need to be a little bit more aware of that. And I had this situation that someone I don't know, a Japanese researcher, came to NIH, gave a seminar about AIDS patients. And I don't remember the detail, but basically his seminar upset a lot of people because of the lack of respect about some of the AIDS patients, I think.
Right.
And that's not because he's really a bad person, but because he just doesn't have habit of thinking about those things. So it's just a system. And I don't know, Japanese society is becoming more and more open to foreigners, so it might change in the long term, but it will probably take a lot of time. So in that sense, I'm actually really, I think it's a good idea for as many Japanese people to visit foreign countries, not just U.S., as possible,
right,
just to see outside.
Yeah. You know, we haven't talked too much about comparing the two systems of science, the Japanese and mm-hmm. the American. You did mention, though, that the American system tended to be more competitive and that the mm-hmm. Japanese system could maybe use more of that. Are there other differences, though, or similarities that you
think
are
important? The biggest difference, I think, is the age, ideas on age. So in Japan, this is an Asian thing, I think. You have to be old enough to be respected. So I'll give you one example. I used to receive a lot of phone calls from Japan offering jobs. So right after I got the job here, I got a telephone call from Japan from someone I didn't know. And that person basically wanted to offer me a full professor job in Tokyo. Hmm. But I didn't know this person. He didn't know me. The first thing he asked me was my age. And I said, what? And then I said I was at the time 35 or something like that. And he just stopped there. And I could tell immediately he was thinking, oh no, this guy is too young. Mm-hmm. Then I said, oh, I know other people who are old enough, and they gave him other names, which was so funny that I used to tell this to other people a lot. So what this is telling you is that if you're too young, you just cannot be independent. So as I said, unless you're a full professor, you're not scientifically independent. So by the time you become full professor, you are usually already worn out. And because the system, you know, you have to be, you have been serving to full professor as a servant, almost, you expect, you know, your assistant professor to do the same thing to you, unless you're like an angel. So that's a bad tradition. So I think, you know, it's in our 30s and 40s that we can do most productive, creative work, and it's almost impossible to be a full professor around that age in Japan. I think that's the biggest problem.
Right. It's odd about the story you tell is that, you know, it's a story about age discrimination. But when people tell stories about age discrimination in America, usually it benefits the young, and in this case, it benefited the older.
So I know a lot of Japanese PIs go back to Japan after they become old, because then they don't have to do much. So in this country, higher you go, more you have to work. But it's opposite in Japan. You have more power and you have to work less. So get a job in this country and retire, sort of half retire in Japan is probably the best way to go.
Right. What is the best part about being or having the job that you have, being a PI?
The best part of having this job is probably to be able to work with young people who you like on something that you're very excited about and share that excitement. That's one big part, I think. I mean, it's not something you can buy, no matter how rich you are. Work with someone who are really interested in something that you are also very interested in. And I, of course, didn't know this part of science until I became a PI, and this is really fun. Another big part is more pure science, I think. When I discovered this ATP-dependent chromatin remodeling when I was a postdoc, I knew I was only the person on Earth who knew about it for a while. Of course, I told this to my boss immediately, and he didn't believe it at the beginning. But that feeling was incredible. I was so excited that when I put my film into Excel Developer, my body was shivering. And that's probably the biggest reward I got from science. Mm-hmm. And once I learned that feeling, it's very hard. It was very hard to think about something, anything else to do in my life. So that's more for a person who does work in his or her hand, I think. But as a PI, as I said, working with people, young people who share interest is a big thing. And also to see students growing up, becoming better at science is also another thing that I found it very fun. But in terms of pure pleasure, nothing is even close to the feeling I had when I discovered something exciting. Mm-hmm. And even now, sometimes students find something really exciting. I get so excited, I cannot sleep, or I keep talking about what we can do or what we should do with a student. That's probably the best part.
Right. The best type of insomnia, right?
Yeah.
When you've got that situation. What is the least pleasant part of your job, though?
Least part. Least pleasurable. I would say... I don't like writing. Writing grant, I know it's a good thing. So it's like taking exams. You know it's a good thing for you in the long term, but it's not like you want to do it. Right. That's one thing. The worst kind of feeling you can have as a principal investigator, I think, is when you feel like you care about someone in your lab's project more than that person. So it happens, I think, to a lot of people, even if the student or postdoc, whoever it is good, because young people tend to have shorter span of interest, or they have their own lives. So, for example, I had a situation that someone had to leave the lab to move on to another job, and we had a big paper submitted, and the person was very, very good, but also he knew he was leaving, so it was not 100% into the story. So, but we only had 2 months to respond to the reviewer's comments, and it was a big paper for us, first big paper from the lab. So I really, really wanted to make this happen. But then, you know, that person has to go to somewhere, had to go to a concert or something. Then sometimes I left out in the lab feeling that, you know, oh, he doesn't care about this as much as I do. Mm-hmm. So that's like the worst thing you can have as a PI, I think. But then I remember I did exactly the same thing to my PI when I was a student. I had a softball game or something in the middle of preparation for a paper. It's even really, really similar situation. Mm-hmm. And my boss got really upset at me, which is understandable. So after I remember that, I just laughed, and then it became a lot easier for me.
Right.
And it's not like this person really doesn't care, but he has so many different things, and he just doesn't know how to separate things. And it went, after that, it's not a big deal.
Right.
But it was an interesting experience.
Well, it was good that you had that memory. It gave you a certain balance and perspective.
Yeah, because it was such a similar situation, you know, such a good parallel.
Uh-huh.
So I just had to laugh.
What were the consequences on you of, you get the Pew Grant in 97.
Mm-hmm.
What were the consequences on you and your lab of getting the Pew Grant?
Oh, it was great. So I think the biggest thing about Pew is it's very flexible, so I could use it any way I want it. And because I immediately got NIH grant, and because what I do is not very expensive, I kept my grant, accumulated my grant as much as possible. I carried over almost to the maximum every year. Now at the end, I wanted to really use Pew my funds in the best way. That is to using crazy experiments that I won't be able to do otherwise, rather than buying consumables or something. And because of the way we were funded, we could do that. So that's why I bought that robot. Mm-hmm. And there's no way I could have afforded it if I didn't have Pew funds. And I knew that would be very useful in the long time, and it would be not only for our lab, but for the other laboratories at the Hutch, not even just our division. And it's something that I knew would like extremely strongly facilitate our research. That would enable us to do kind of experiments that we won't be able to do otherwise. So I think that was the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, I use it for some other things, smaller purchases. But in that sense, I think I made good use of that money.
Right. I'm curious, how much did the robot cost?
That whole thing cost about $100,000.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that's a big chunk of change. What would you tell, let's assume maybe that the Pew people were here, they're interested in improving, you know, the program. You know that it included the annual meetings, the five-year mm-hmm. anniversary meetings, networking, all of that. Is there any way that perhaps the Pew could improve that program and make it even a better grant?
Make it 10 years. No, make just kidding.
All right.
Give us more money. One thing I wish I did more probably was to talk to people in advisory committee more, because they are obviously all very good scientists, and I wish we had time. I don't know what to do. One thing, for example, one kind of meeting I really like to go is Gordon conferences. The reason is because it has a lot of free time. It's held in middle of nowhere, and there's a lot of free time in the middle, so people stay around and talk a lot. Mm-hmm. And in Pew, we have a lot of scientific sessions, which is fun, but also we have a ton of extracurricular thing, which is good. But maybe we can leave out some time, not going anywhere, just people stay around and chat for hours. And that might help. And make sure that people don't go back to their room and do writing.
Right. Lock their doors.
Yeah. And with and without alcohol, it doesn't matter. I did become good friends with many people only in the last couple meetings. And I wish, I wish I did this a little bit earlier. And, you know, first couple of years, then people tend to be shy. And it's even more the case with advisory committee, advisory board members. So if anything, if we had more opportunities to talk to people, that might be a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Another big question. I only got three more left. What one or two measures would you believe help improve the quality of science overall that's being done in the U.S.? Besides, you know, having billions of dollars more for it than
Let's see. That's tough. To improve, I think obviously the best thing is to keep attracting the best student to science. Because people comes first. And I heard people worry about it, that the best students tend to go to different directions. If that's the case, probably we have to make serious effort to attract best students to science. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's going to improve or just to keep a science level high, but that's probably the most important thing. Mm-hmm. How to keep young people's interest in science, I think it's probably the biggest thing.
Do you have any ideas about how that might be done?
One thing, again, is give enough information and opportunities for people who are willing, because there are people who are interested in science naturally. And if there are systems they can take advantage of when they want to do something about science, it's there, then that only helps, I think. Mm-hmm. Just provide more information and more opportunities to young people that they can actually experience science.
Yeah. As of today, what is the most important lesson that you've learned as a lab manager and as a scientist that you wish you had known when you started down this path, you know, so many years ago? Any great truth that you could pass on to a budding scientist?
For management, I think the best tool for me is to be positive. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I have a policy that I don't talk to students if I'm upset. I wait until I'm calm down and talk to them. And I don't try not to say things like, don't do this because this is no good, or I don't take you because you're not good enough, something like that. No negative thing. I try to say, you'd better do this because this is good for you. Or you'd better take alternative path because it's likely that you're going to be more happy in that way. Of course, I can't say from their point of view, but I think it's working positively so far. We'll see. But that's one thing, I think. And I try not to say much about negative things. And I don't know if I can stay in this way forever, but other than that, yeah, I think that's about it.
All right. Final question. Is there anything that we haven't covered or anything that you'd like to clarify, any topic we haven't brought up that we should before we end?
I don't know. It's been pretty thorough, I think.
Okay. And we try to make it thorough.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for allowing us to come here, allowing me to talk with you.
It's a pleasure.
Time. Thank you.
It's fun.